And it's obviously great that some nice art comes out of it, but even if it didn't, there would still be all this value in
the doing.
The doing. Not even just value for you now, but in value for the people who are watching your streams. And just to pull the veil back a little bit, we originally met for this interview in October, early November, somewhere in there. And I didn't push the right button on the recorder, and our conversation was erased. Well, never even recorded, not erased. So this too is iterative, this process. But at that point, we talked about this project, the International Artists Alliance, and you had been talking about just the painting. And I don't know if you had started doing the streams at that point, or if you had just started.
No, we've been doing it for a while, but we are absolutely, totally green, scared, little novices. Half of us had never been on camera and in front of anybody. And it's just been an amazing journey that we've kind of jumped off a cliff holding hands together. But at the same time, it just ties right into what I'm also doing with my work, because mm-hmm. I was saving avocados. My mom saved them for her pits for me for 3 years. She was like, "Oh, you like the avocado pits? I eat a lot of them. Save them for me." Had them in a cupboard. Pandemic, they got moved. People were like, "What are these?" Almost threw them away, whatever. But in the back of my mind, I know they're there, and I want to make a piece of art. And I just pulled a print this week where the dye I made from the avocados was just absolutely what I wanted. It did exactly what I needed it to do. It's chemistry, but the more I do the ritual of the making the dye and playing with the chemistry, the more satisfying the results.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that, obviously the science informs the process, right?
But, very much.
But then I would think that once you do it enough, it gets to a point where it feels less like laboratory science, and again, more just like something that you can do, and you can sort of tweak things, not necessarily based on the science says this, but your experience now tells you.
It's more alchemy now.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you looked at my shelf, it looks like a crazy mad scientist, is doing something there, because I have lichen in fermentation jars, and I have bear lichen, and I have bark, and I have all kinds of stuff, dried goldenrod bags of people throw out their eucalyptus out of their floral bouquets. I go along, I see it in the garbage, I grab it. I got stuff, okay? The guy pruned his Japanese maple last year across the way, and then he strewed it across his backyard, and I was just pulling Japanese maple leaves. I have such a big stash of dry Japanese maple that it's in the way. So yes, I look like a mad scientist, and now it's kind of intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the ritual part of making the art, because I do all of that before I get to the painting. And by the time I've done the botanical printing, the painting has kind of coalesced like an improv developing over time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just sit down and I paint into it, and it's, I don't know, it as a creative process, I personally find it extremely satisfying.
I do also think there's something in the mad scientist, the process of sort of going and collecting ingredients and doing this work on them. And it brings to mind the idea of magic, because you're doing a ritual, you're gathering the ingredients, you're doing the ritual, and it is having a desired effect, right? You are doing this ritual to process something within yourself, or to evoke emotions or responses in other people. And just thinking about how in reality and history and in myth there is this idea of magic, or being able to change people or change yourself through these rituals, and yet there's also this that it's a real tangible thing that you can do. That just fascinates me.
And hang on your wall.
Yeah.
When you're finished. And you're right, there is magic involved. For me, it's the magic of nature that I'm trying to translate and share.
Mm-hmm.
Because, we live in a beautiful, beautiful part of the world. And I get to go on walks in the temperate rainforest and massive cedars and Douglas fir and arbutus and hanging usnea lichen are just abundant. And one of the reasons why I make this work is because after a windstorm, there is lichen on the ground that I can sustainably forage. Yeah. And people from all over the world try to reprimand me. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry, but this was on the ground. People were walking it into the mud. So it's okay to pick it up off the ground when it's been blown off its substrate. Mm-hmm. And this is how you do it sustainably. So I'm not going to make more than I need, which is one of the qualities and ethos of my work. I'm not going to go gather a huge garbage bag full of lichen.
You're not doing industrial dye production, right?
No, this is a practice that reflects the environment that I'm in. So if I move and there's no lichen being blown down from the trees where I move, then I'm not making my dye from that. I'm making it from something else that's abundant in that environment. And that's why my work is environmental art, because it is reflective of the place I'm in, the psychogeography of that place in that region. So when I'm in Trinidad, I get to have access to teak and mahogany and all kinds of exciting things that I don't have here that I wouldn't dream of importing or exporting, because that's not sustainable, right? So it's just about, like, what's abundant in my environment and how can I reflect the magic of my encounters with these beautiful, I mean, salmon and bald eagles and, you know, heron and just everything that I encounter on my walks. That's where the magic is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to just convey. And just, if I don't express it somehow, my art is going to, like, it's going to stay bottled up in me and I'm going to, like, talk to people about it.
Heaven forbid, right?
All right. Or God forbid, burst into song. So, you know, when you're blessed to be in an environment that's kind of magical, like, how dare I not share it with other people, right? And then when you talk about magic, there is that concept of the artist as shaman,
mm-hmm.
and the artist as reflection of society. And maybe because I've gone through so much challenges and I was medically misdiagnosed for over 30 years, my body's not the same. Being able to walk in the woods is a huge privilege for me, because sometimes I can't walk at all. And that's part of why I feel joy. And I feel the gratitude and the magic every single time I go for a walk in the forest. Because there are times when I can't do it. There was a time where I had to relearn how to walk physically. So perhaps when you lose something as a member of society who has, maybe I have a certain perspective that I'm able to just see the magic, where it's just normal for everybody else walking past it because they never lost their ability to access it.
Mm-hmm. You take it for granted.
Absolutely. And I don't. So it's not just the making of the art, as you say. It's the whole ritual of translating my experience in nature. And I mean, often that's in the downtown east side here on Alexander Street. But there's a strip there down at the end, a whole bunch of rose bushes. And I'm telling you, they save my life sometimes. And it's just a little strip of rose bushes that a company planted and take care of in the downtown east side. But that's nature. And I can collect a whole bunch of stuff off those rose bushes,
yeah,
to use in my work. And then it's like, my work looks so abundant and she must live in a garden, and I live in the downtown east side. But I see that part of it. And that's, I guess, what I bring to the whole table as an artist, the unique artist's eye, right?
Yeah, I think that's really powerful, to be able to see what is overlooked and to see the beauty in the everyday and in the things that are right there underfoot.
I think that's one reason, you know, when you go through the fire, for a lot of people who've been through something major, most people have, that's one of the things you get at the other side. You know, a lot of people who've survived cancer have often said, I wouldn't change it because of who I became,
mm-hmm.
after I had that experience, right? So it's like art. It encompasses the poignancy and the pain and the beauty in life at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
In the same place.
Yeah. On that note, and I'm not asking you to give specific clinical advice in any way, but if someone wanted to make art to work through some trauma or grief or whatever. What would your sort of general advice be on how to start, how to approach it?
Well, obviously, ideally, you'd find an expressive arts therapist who can help you along the way, someone like myself. And there's a trade association you can go to find people who are qualified and certified, like I am. But, you know, if you're just like entry level and you have no resources and you don't know what to do, get an adult coloring book and start there. Start with something that you're intuitively attracted to and just start playing with color. And then by the time you've gotten halfway through that adult coloring book, maybe you've started doodling. Maybe you're going to let yourself write a couple poems after you've been drawing a little bit in your adult coloring book. Sing, pick up your bongo that you had in the corner getting dust for years and years. Listen to a bit more music. Sing along. All of that is expressive arts therapy. Every single aspect of it. Go to a play. Go to a play that moves you. That's a really good thing to do if you can afford it. And if you can't afford it, call up the box office and ask them if they have any of those complimentary tickets, because sometimes they would love to just get some seats, people in the seats. There are so many things that are therapeutic, that are through the arts, that we don't realize until, I mean, I went to a play when I was like 15 with my dad, and it was by Thompson Highway. It was the Red Sisters, and it was Quebec. In Quebec at the Centaur Theater. And when people left the play and were in the lobby, everybody was talking to each other like, wow, and this part, and when she did this, total strangers were animated and passionate and exclaiming to one another and sharing with each other because of the impact of the actors and the words and of this drama that had everybody just like sharing, whoa. And in Quebec, most people just are anonymous. We don't even know if we speak English or French because you keep your mouth shut most of the time. And it was a huge learning experience for me at a young age about the power of the arts. I mean, it was so powerful, such a powerful experience. That's expressive arts therapy in action right there.
Right. Yeah, the arts very often get just categorized as sort of like pop culture or culture generally. But I mean, like, well, what is culture if not art, and talking about things through art or words or whatever?
Yeah. Art is if you're writing or you're taking photos or you're singing or coming up with a ditty of your own. I mean, a lot of people have their own little rhymes. That's all of it is creative. I call it creative activity. You don't have to label it as art. It's creative activity. And there is absolutely healing through creative activity, and everyone has access to it. Not relegating it to artists only has been a terrible thing in society. And it used to be, I'm old enough to remember, where everybody had a piano or a guitar, and there was always somebody in a gathering of at least 6 or 7 people who could play it decently enough for us to sing along together.
Yeah.
And that was a time before streaming and a time before the internet and a time before. And now everybody's throwing out their pianos and letting them rot in the alleys. And it's heartbreaking because it was a way of coming together through using the arts where we didn't relegate it to the elite and to the people who were trained to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. In university, you'd go to a party and somebody would have a guitar and that would happen, right? But I'm a sports fan, and they sing the anthems before the games. And I'm not a big national anthem person. I'm not a very nationalistic person, generally.
Patriotic.
Yeah. And I think there are plenty of reasons not to sing the national anthem. That being said, being in a room full of people, just everyone in the room singing in unison the same song, a song they all know the words and the melody to, is a very profound experience. And I guess, you know, if I went to church, I would probably have that experience more. But, you know, aside from that, I can't really think of very many times in my day-to-day life where, yeah, I'm just singing with my friends.
So powerful, though.
Yeah, absolutely.
When I was in a dark place, I joined the Sing City Rock Choir here in Vancouver, run by Laura Lang, who is a pro. They're having, I think, their, I don't know, 13th or 15th anniversary coming up, with Joni Taylor singing their feature. But I joined a choir because I because of my experience and my training and everything, and intuitively I knew, oh, I'm not in a good place. I'm a single mom. I can't let this just go. And I took the time after work at the end of the day to go to an evening choir. And it was so, yeah, in that standing, and especially the people who've done it before, so they're decently good at it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And then we were doing it, you know, with the altos and the sopranos and everybody.
You're singing different interlocking parts.
Oh, the harmonies. It was so powerful and better than an antidepressant could ever be.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying. It was so worth it, and I encourage anybody to, you know, if you're feeling in the doldrums a little bit, join a choir. It feels amazing, and then you don't have to worry about the patriotic thing.
Yeah, probably a better option. Cheaper to get into as well. You know, you're not spending $100 on your ticket to get in the door.
I think it's more than 100 now.
Yeah. Well, Rose, this has been a lot of fun. Where can people find out more about you and your work? What's the best way?
Yeah, I have a Facebook page. It's called Rose L. Williams Arts. You can find me there on Instagram. I have a website, roselwilliamsarts.com. And as I said, if you're interested in expressive arts therapy, reach out. Even if you don't want to work with me, I can maybe help you find somebody. And check us out every Thursday on my Facebook page, live at 12:30, and you're going to hear us talk, the International Art Alliance, just, you know, discuss art talks. And sometimes they come out like art panels, and sometimes we're just joking around, and sometimes we're opening boxes and showing the paintings as they're developing. So you never know.
Cool. Well, this is going to air on Thursday morning, so you can tune in later, head to Rose's Facebook page, and get even more.
I can't thank you enough, Jesse.
Great. Yeah, thanks for coming on. It's been great chatting. That was my chat with Rose L. Williams. You can find her on Facebook this afternoon for another installment from the International Artist Alliance. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, campus community radio from Simon Fraser University. I'm Jesse, and we got about 13 minutes left, so I'm going to play us out with a little bit of music. This is from South Korean band Paranul, from a record called After the Magic, which I discovered yesterday also. Super good shoegazy stuff. And we're going to hear the third track on the record. This is called Arrival.
tracking birds can be tricky, even with GPS technology. Around 70% of bird species are just too small to carry a GPS battery. But recently, Australian scientists developed GPS trackers that looked like little backpacks and weighed less than a gram. They could charge wirelessly while the birds visited a feeding station and could be quickly released with a magnet when the study was over. This would be less of a disturbance for the birds. But there were some unforeseen complications. The researchers fastened their trackers on 5 wild Australian magpies. Almost immediately, one magpie tried to escape from the backpack. Another magpie flew over to help. She managed to peck exactly at the tracker's 1 millimeter weak spot, which was built in so the magnetic release could work. It only took 10 minutes for the birds to find it. Soon, all of the magpies were tracker-free. The bright side was an unexpected discovery. The magpies showed evidence of altruism by helping others without any benefit to themselves. A rare behavior among birds. Scientists are looking for a less intelligent and less social species to try these state-of-the-art trackers on next. Lizards are possible candidates. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You need to do.